Healthcare Today is produced and paid for by the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to wdev@radiovermont.com. Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of Healthcare Today. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers. We're going to talk today about medications, in particular, how new medicines are discovered, how they're tested in the laboratory, how they're tested on people, and how they're brought to market. Our guest today is someone I'm very honored to welcome back, Dr. Philip Schein, who was here with us last year. Dr. Schein is widely regarded as a leading international authority on the pharmacology of anti-cancer medications and the treatment of cancer. He began his career at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, went from there to Georgetown University's Medical School, where he was professor of medicine and chief of medical oncology at Georgetown's Lombardi Cancer Center. He then went on to join Smith, Kline, and French, the international pharmaceutical company, as their vice president of worldwide clinical research and development, and subsequently founded his own pharmaceutical company, U.S. Bioscience. He has been ranked as one of the top 120 doctors in America and among the four top physicians in oncology. Dr. Schein, welcome back to Healthcare Today.
Thank you, Lewis. Pleasure to be here.
Well, I thought we would start, you know, people may not be aware of what it takes to bring a medicine to market. I do recall some 30 years ago as a pre-med student in Washington, D.C. at Georgetown University, being in the lab with one of your absolutely remarkable colleagues at the time, Dr. Hushi Talabian, as he basically was swirling beakers of chemicals, beginning the process of looking for new medications. Is that still the way it's done? Where do the ideas germinate now and begin for a new medication?
Well, we're the beneficiary of another three decades of investment in understanding the biology of human disease, in my case, cancer cells, so that we've moved from an era that I would describe as perhaps enlightened empiricism to much more targeted therapy. We have identified molecular targets, and we can now develop drugs that are specifically designed to interdict, to interfere with the action of these targets, whether they're something on the outside of the cell, on the cell membrane, perhaps a receptor, or a molecular pathway within the cell that can be interrupted, or in the case of some cancer therapies, a direct attack on the cell's DNA itself. But in any case, we have, over the course of the years, identified specific targets for therapeutic development across a wide range of human diseases. So it's much more efficient these days than it perhaps was in the past.
So if you were to sit down and say, I would like to come up with a new medication to treat such and such a cancer, what would be the first thing you would do?
Well, we would hopefully would have a three-dimensional structure that we could work with, the actual target itself. And using computerized designs, we could fashion a number of new drugs, new therapeutics, to whether they be new chemical entities or new biologic entities, and hope that they could specifically attack a specific vulnerable site on that target, and we would make a lot of them, perhaps several thousand, and with the process of high throughput screening, as it's called, we would test for the ability of our new chemicals to actually attack the site. And then we would work from there, obviously with a very large library of potential candidate drugs, and then the process of defining which one, if any of them, is sufficiently effective and safe so that could be eventually made into a new therapeutic that would enter the first human clinical trials.
Is there one medication that you've been involved with that you could sort of tell us about and how that worked?
Oh, there was one in particular that was of great interest. A lot of the exploratory work was done by the U.S. Army, but it was the first FDA-approved radiation-protective agent. But it was originally designed for military uses at a time when the United States was developing the neutron bomb. There was an urgent need to try to find a drug that could be administered to troops that might be exposed to radiation to allow them to survive that exposure. So back in the 1960s, the Army began exploring a number of chemicals for their potential radiation protective properties. They screened, and this is the process of taking lots of chemicals and screening them using various systems for efficacy. They screened over 4,000, and from that group they selected one, a drug that they called WR2721. That was its designation. We now know it today. Its generic name is amifostine. Commercial name was ethyl. But they found this drug, when administered to mice, would allow these animals to withstand lethal doses of radiation. The problem for the Army was that they could never develop the drug so that it could be administered orally. And, of course, an intravenously administered agent is somewhat impractical, you know, on the battlefield, certainly when you're dealing with a large number of troops. But after several years, that classified research project became unclassified. The data were made available, and oncologists began exploring the drug in the laboratory to see if its radiation protective properties could be used for therapeutic radiation and for drugs that are regarded generically as radiomimetic, certain drugs which physically attack DNA and alter its structure and function, something that radiation can do through the delivery of energy. So they began exploring the drug, and they found that, indeed, it looked like it might have utility in the field of oncology. And the principal requirement was that the drug be selective for normal tissues and not protect the tumor, which obviously would obviate, you know, the role of the therapeutic you're using. You don't want to protect the cancer. And that property was found for many tumors, and it's a drug that I was able to develop from those initial findings straight through to an ultimate FDA approval and European approval as well. So it was an example of taking the fruits of research, which were directed to an entirely different purpose, and diverting them to a particular need, an unmet need in the area of cancer therapeutics, and that was radiation and protection and protection against some of the more toxic features of commonly used anti-cancer.
Have you seen that in other cases where a medication or treatment previously used for another purpose gets repurposed in order to use for example, treatment of cancer in this case?
Yes, that has happened from time to time, particularly as we get enlightened about mechanisms and say, oh, that's the way this drug works. Let's apply it somewhere else where we know the target is similar and or the molecular pathway is one that we think we can better interrupt. So I think you have to be opportunistic, and the field is constantly looking and searching for new opportunities, and some of which will come from just that kind of research.
So you mentioned first whether it's in the wet lab with, you know, sloshing chemicals around or through computerized design of new molecules, they have to be tested. And almost in every case, they are generally tested on animals first. You mentioned mice. It's not any mice, right, that you can just go out and pick up a mouse from the street that you're going to test this on. This is a whole industry in and of itself, is it not?
It is. So that it, you need to have a uniform system so it's reproducible and the results can be transferred from one drug to another because you've used uniform systems. But you can look at the whole process, conceptually, if you can envision a large funnel, and the funnel, of course, has a very large circumference at the top. You can pour lots of things into it. If we say we pour in, let's say, 10,000 new chemical entities that we've screened and have shown initial signs that maybe there's something there, by the time we get to that more narrow portion of the funnel at the very end, and that process will take many years, we may end up with one or two drugs that have made it through the entire process and will be used, clinically with an FDA approval. So I would describe the entire process as very long, generally about 10 years, very expensive. There have been various estimates, but perhaps the most authoritative source is at Tufts. They have a specific center, the Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development, where they estimate for getting a new FDA approval with all the costs associated with it and all the dry holes that are dug across the years, that it's somewhere in the range of $1.5 billion and as much as $2.5 billion. Is the nature of the investment that has to be made over that perhaps 10-year time frame in order to get an approved product, meaning FDA approved. And the number that make it, let us say if we start in clinical testing with, let's say, 10 agents, current data would suggest that perhaps one out of the 10% will actually make it through the human testing phases, phase one, phase two, phase three, as they describe it, and actually gain that FDA approval. So that you could see, again, very long, expensive, and very risk-laden process, and very few companies really have the staying power to be able to undertake this type of exercise.
And one of the components, of course, is animal testing. You know, in recent decades, there's been a obviously a focus on also protecting the rights of animals, whether they be mice, but also as you go up the chain to dogs, cats, dogs, and of course primates, non-human primates. How has that affected the overall time and financial and aspects and the way you actually do research with all of the new regulations in regards to animal treatment?
Well, it's a very relevant question and something that I've spent a lot of time on in the past. One of my assignments, during the Vietnam War, there were a few of us that were sent not to Vietnam to a field hospital, but to a laboratory at the National Institutes of Health. We described ourselves as the Yellow Berets, the chosen few who were sent to a laboratory in Bethesda, Maryland. My assignment was with the National Cancer Institute, and while I was given a laboratory to do my own personal research, I also had responsibility for managing aspects of the Cancer Institute's drug development program, specifically the animal toxicology side of it. And, of course, I was a physician for humans, but I had to learn animal toxicology. But I came anew to that whole challenge and began asking questions like, how good are these data that are being generated, particularly from dogs and monkeys, and does anybody use it? Does it have predictive validity? So I undertook, during about a two-year period with colleagues, a retrospective analysis of just how well the animals did in making predictions about what type of side effects, serious adverse reactions, might emerge in the human work. And, of course, we were dealing with cancer drugs, So they were predictably toxic. We could expect toxicity from them. But the idea was to compare what forms of toxicities were seen, which organs were affected. Was it the bone marrow, the liver, the kidney, other organs, in each of the species? And did the animals actually predict for what would happen in the humans? And at the end of the day, we found some real surprises in that generally the animals didn't do a very good job. They grossly overpredicted for certain forms of toxicity that were not seen in humans, and they missed some critically important toxicities, side effects, that were seen in the human work but were not seen in the animals. And, of course, that led to a great deal of retrospective study as to why that occurred. But overall, so the position that I adopted was that while you can't discount any of the animal data, you have to understand that it's not going to be entirely valid in terms of its predictions. And there's some reasons for that. In the animal work, you tend to push to side effects. You push higher and higher and higher, trying to see the side effects emerge. Whereas in the human studies, you're dealing under strict ethical guidelines, and you cannot do that, and you should not do that. You obviously treat when you're doing the early work with a new drug to the time when the first side effects emerge, and then you tend to back off.
As you know, across the country, dog labs in medical schools are almost non-existent now, and I think that there are some people that make an argument that whether it's dogs or particularly non-human primates that they obviously aren't giving permission to be in the study, and as animals more and more take on the legal classification of personhood of sorts, this is going to be an issue.
I think there's a good rationale for that, too. And I think I have a unique opportunity. There was a time when I was chairing the FDA's External Review Committee for Cancer Drugs, so-called ODAC, Oncologic Drugs Review Committee. And I made the case during those couple of years when I was serving in that capacity that the animal data really were misleading and obviously expensive to generate, and that we were doing a disservice to the animals, and that perhaps we needed much less of this information, and we're still able to safely introduce a new drug into the first humans without having all this extensive toxicology work. And the FDA allowed me to convene a small group of animal toxicologists and who were, as you might expect, initially resistant to some of these ideas. But nevertheless, we ended up with some recommendations that the FDA largely accepted. And at that point, this goes back to the early 1980s, the FDA backed off on its requirements for large animal studies for the purposes of initiating clinical studies in humans. And some other countries, and particularly the UK, went even further. And the general concept arose, at least in my own mind, two things. That the animal data, and it could be mice rather than dogs, predict with reasonable surety what would represent a safe starting dose in humans. And, of course, if you can get the drug in safely the first couple of times, you then have the liberty to gradually increase the dose in subsequent human subjects in order to determine an effective dose range and what those toxicities emerge. The other concept that I've developed and have expounded many times is that the only validated model for human toxicity is the intact human subject. You need to do this work in patients. The animals will give you a little bit of guidance, and you can never discount the animal data. You have to look for what it's predicting. But nevertheless, the only data that you can fully trust at the end of the day, again, this is my personal concept, is the human data. And
people who are fond of animals out there are probably applauding you right now for those efforts. Let's talk about the three, generally thought of as three phases of initial phases of drug development, and you were began to talk about testing in humans and dosages, and that would be phase one. Is that correct? And could you talk about phase one studies?
Right. So at this point, let's just quickly review what has been done, because it's been a massive amount of work that's undergone, you know, taken place in the so-called preclinical setting, the laboratory phase. You've got a new chemical. You made enough of it to be able to test. And obviously, you're going from milligram quantities to the time when you're going to need kilograms or perhaps tons of drug. So you've got to be able to scale up and have a method for doing that. You found a formulation. Is the drug going to be given orally, or is it going to be given intravenously or intramuscularly? Will it be an aerosol that you inhale? So all these decisions are being made, and those formulations have to be prepared and they have to be tested. And once they're available, then you have to undertake the safety testing, which you described. So there's some amount of animal work to be done, certainly to determine a safe starting dose. But you can see that there's been a massive amount of work done before you get to the point where you submit to the FDA what is known as an investigational new drug application, or so-called IND, the abbreviations. And they then accept it or not. If they accept it, then you're then free to go ahead into clinical testing. And that first phase is called phase one. And it depends upon the class of drug that you're working with. For most drugs for benign diseases, let's say for rheumatoid arthritis, that testing, that phase one testing, is usually conducted in healthy volunteers. And the intent is to determine the safety of the drug and to get some information about dosing. You start with what you hope will be a very safe initial dose, and then you increase the dose in subsequent subjects for the purpose of defining how far up can you go in your dosing and what doses will you be required in order to.
Let me just ask you this. Maybe some people might be interested in this. You're talking about healthy volunteers who don't have the disease under question. Who volunteers for a phase one study as a healthy volunteer? Tell me about some of the people that volunteer.
Well, there's, again, some checkered history in the field has evolved. There have been in decades past, you know, asking for prison inmates, volunteers. You know, those are the dark days of development. Now it's asking anybody, you know, available, who is basically healthy, willing to undertake this study. In some cases, it may be students, and you have to be very careful about the ethics of all of this to someone who may need some money and is willing to commit their body to some clinical study. Again, this has to be approached very, very carefully, the highest standard of ethics, full disclosure to the subject who is volunteering, and with a lot of safeguards.
Usually these go before what are called institutional review boards?
Exactly. An institutional review board, or so-called IRB, reviews the methodologies can be employed and has the obligation of following up, where the investigator continues to submit updated information so the IRB can track what's going on and can understand that the project is being conducted with all the necessary safeguards, and that the volunteer has the opportunity of bailing out of that study, stopping their commitment at any time. Now the alternative in terms of cancer drugs, it's very different in that the actual phase one testing is typically carried out in patients, not volunteers, but patients with the actual diseases that may ultimately be the subjects, you know, the target types of diseases that the drug will be used to treat. So it's very different in the field of cancer. It's patients with active cancer, whereas for most drugs for so-called benign disease, it's healthy volunteers. But the overall intent in all those studies gets some initial indication of the safety of the product and determining what doses you can treat with and whether those doses have any chance of being effective.
I would imagine, too, for example, in the world of cancer treatment, that those people who volunteer become part of a phase one study are people who are fairly desperate at that point because they, if you're on an effective cancer treatment that's working for you, you're unlikely to switch off and join a phase one study. So these are people who are looking for hope, looking for any hope that a new drug might offer.
Yes, but at the same time, you can't promise or overpromise. So a typical informed consent statement, which the patient must sign, it will make it very clear that this is a new drug. It may ultimately be proven to not have efficacy at all, and that the doses that they're going to receive are the initial doses. They may be subtherapeutic, meaning they may not be high enough to actually be effective, and that subsequent to what the patient is doing, in essence, you can say with some certainty, is making a contribution of new data that may ultimately be of benefit to subsequent generations of patients that perhaps are being treated at what might then become recognized as the most effective and safest dose.
So I think it's fair to say, aside from the fact that these are patients who would like to have a chance to try a new medication, there's also a great deal of altruism, isn't there? Because they're not doing very well, they're not feeling well, and yet they're volunteering to help perhaps future generations.
Exactly the case, Lewis. Absolutely the case.
Yeah.
And, again, there has to be complete disclosure. They have to understand where they're getting to. But as you mentioned, these are individuals who, by definition, have run out of other options.
We are going to be back in just a short while after the break. We're back with Healthcare Today. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers, and we're talking with Dr. Philip Schein, noted oncologist and pharmaceutical executive. So, Dr. Schein, we talked about animal testing or preclinical testing. We talked about phase one, in which toxicity and dosing is examined. Assuming that no terrible health or safety signals have emerged through phase one, the new potentially new medication moves on to phase two. What happens in phase two?
Well, phase two, first of all, there are a very small number of patients in phase one. You limit that. Phase two are studies where you're trying to get an initial reading of the efficacy of the drug, and you're further exploring the safety of the agent in small numbers of patients. So we made a distinction between healthy volunteers versus patients for all classes of drugs. Phase two is conducted in the patients, which the drug might ultimately be indicated, as suggested by how it targets in various tissues. So these are relatively small studies, but you're looking for what's known as a signal, an indication that the target you're approaching is being affected in a positive way. So if it's infection, it's control of infection. If it's cancer, you may be looking for a reduction in the size of the tumor, but these initial signs that you actually have something that is efficacious is the goal of phase two testing. Again, the numbers of patients typically relatively small.
In order to move on to the final one of the final stages, stage three, how efficacious does a medication have to be to pass basically into phase three, to get through phase two?
That will depend upon the disease in question. For certain diseases, where there are already established and very good therapies, you're looking for something that really represents a very serious advance in treatment. For certain forms of cancer, as an example, where there are relatively few effective treatments, the signal may be relatively modest, but nevertheless important enough so you say, okay, let's move this up and learn more about it in more extensive phase three clinical trials. So you're making estimates in phase two. You're not making those decisions based on strong statistical correlations.
And these are big financial decisions, right? Because before you go to phase three, which is presumably going to be even larger, in terms of the number of people involved and more expensive, you have to make a decision, I guess, as a pharmaceutical executive and researcher, is this worth going to phase three?
Exactly. So these are the so-called very difficult go, no-go decisions that every pharmaceutical biotech company has to make, typically by committee. Always very difficult whether to pull the trigger and move forward into a phase three testing, which may involve thousands of human subjects at enormous expense, making that commitment without absolute assurance that at the end of the day, you're going to have a product that can be approved. It is a gamble, in essence, but you're looking for a very strong signal indication to move forward based upon your phase two testing in those initial.
So riverboat gamblers have nothing on the pharmaceutical executives, right?
Not at all. And you get a lot of gray hairs. And, of course, at each stage, you're having to make very important judgments about what you're seeing. And, of course, the highest degree of ethical decision-making has to be applied here. You're dealing with human subjects receiving experimental chemicals. So it's a very daunting exercise.
Not for the faint of heart. Let's talk about phase three. So that what happens in phase three?
Well, these are large so-called pivotal trials determining safety and efficacy. And you have to have a sufficiently large number of patients with a targeted disease in order to be able to establish efficacy and safety with a fair degree of statistical precision. So estimates are made before you start as to how many subjects will be required in order to get that type of result to be convincing, first for yourself that you actually have a new drug of value, and then to be able to convince a regulatory agency in the United States, that's the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, that you have a drug that is safe, effective, and represents a significant addition potentially to the available drugs.
So this is really, this is where we get, you get into competition, because phase one and two, it's really more, does it work? Now you're saying, does it work as well or better than other things on the market?
Yep, and that may influence your design. There may be situations where there is not an acceptable standard, so you have nothing to compare against, and you may consider a so-called placebo-controlled phase three trial, in which the half of the individuals or some proportion of the individuals are not receiving an active treatment. In cancer development, that is rarely, if ever, done. Typically, the patient is offered some alternative treatment as a comparator. So in large measure, you're doing comparison. Your new drug versus some established therapy, can you compete against what represents the standard available in the field at that time? Or the studies may be of different design, where you're combining. You're adding your drug to an established therapy to determine whether or not it makes a very important contribution to efficacy relative to using the standard treatment alone. So there are various designs that can be employed for making these determinations as to whether or not a drug is sufficiently good enough to actually be approved and be placed on the market.
And then you go, of course, your FDA is probably involved all along the way, but once your phase three is completed, you gather your data and you go to Washington or Bethesda or Rockville, I believe it is, and you present this to the FDA.
Yeah, it typically initially, of course, you're hoping to communicate with the FDA as you move along, and some new designations have been developed over the course of years that can allow for more effective communication than perhaps in the past. But typically, these are for drugs that are showing a promising activity in their early stages and are designated a breakthrough therapy or something that requiring a fast-track mechanism, so to speak. So there's a fair amount of communication between the agency and the investigators along that route. But ultimately, you package all your data. So that means going back from the earliest phases when you were just screening for a new chemical in terms of whether or not it could attack a specific target. But all the chemical data, all the manufacturing data, the safety data in animals or in laboratory testing of other types, all that is packaged along with all the clinical data into what's known as an NDA or a new drug application. And that typically that application fills many, many boxes of paper. Of course, a lot of it now can be done with digital transmission. But the amount of data is absolutely enormous. It's been collected over many years in a very multidisciplinary way, from basic chemistry through clinical work, and all that is submitted to the FDA to review. And they're given a certain amount of time to review it. And if there is a need, then you may have an opportunity to appear publicly in front of one of the FDA's constituted advisory committees to make a presentation.
Let's talk about the FDA for a minute. Like so many other government institutions, it has been politicized to some degree. I think this probably began in the mid-1980s with AIDS, when there was concern that the FDA was not moving quickly enough to approve some of the AIDS drugs. But we've seen recently some concern and controversy, for example, in the field of Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's medication to treat Alzheimer's, or at least mild Alzheimer's, was approved despite a number of leading researchers' concerns that it was hugely expensive and not very effective. There's also been concern that the FDA is now, in order to accelerate the approval process, that they are getting funding or help from the very companies they're overseeing. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I would say, first of all, they've got an extraordinarily difficult job. They're having to make judgments, and sometimes the data are not, you know, that certain. So decisions have to be made. I think in the case of the recent Alzheimer drug approval, that was almost without precedent, where the FDA did something against the judgment of its advisory committee and perhaps some of its own internal employees, but made a judgment that the field had suffered for so long without the availability of a new treatment, that something that was perhaps not perfect by any means should be made available as an option, but probably not a very good option. But that was an extraordinary decision, again, without very much precedent. Now, a similar precedent, the only one that comes to mind, goes back to the days that you were describing, when HIV was extremely active in various communities, and we had no drug for it, really not effective drug, a drug for some of the complications, but not the virus itself. And the FDA took a very proactive role, but after, you know, a lot of criticism, and took the application made by one of the large pharmaceutical companies and basically rewrote it to their own satisfaction and approved the drug and got it on the market. That was an extraordinary precedent as well. It shows that in rare, very rare instances, the FDA can become a very active party to the issue of drug approval, rather than a more passive recipient of the information provided by the drug sponsor, and then making judgments internally as well as using its external advisory committees, typically experts in academic centers or in other positions, including ethicists, who come together and help the FDA make the judgments as to whether a new chemical entity, the data associated with it, is sufficiently strong to warrant approval and for the agent to be made available to the public at large.
We've moved into an era of what's called biologics, particularly in cancer treatment, but in a number of other diseases as well. Can you talk a little bit about that? How does that affect the whole testing process, and how does that affect cost?
Well, it's a lot of the issues really remain, but some new ones have arisen, and some others have gone away. I think the biologic therapy system is rather the beneficiary of the 30, 40 years of investment in understanding the biology of cancer cells and identifying the targets so that new therapies can be designed to attack them. and, of course, understanding the immunologic differences of cancer cells versus normal cells that usually reside in the body, and being able to identify them. We've seen a whole body of new work created over the course of the last 15-20 years that is much more targeted, much more rational in its design relative to past years, which were, again, I describe as some enlightened empiricism, screening systems, but without the rationale of knowing really what the target should be. In the case of biologics, it's much more the case. For example, so-called monoclonal antibodies can recognize features on the surface of a cancer cell, a receptor, and having seen it, can attack it, and with that, hopefully, destroy that cell, or at least impair its ability to divide and invade. So it's opened up a whole new field. And some of that has come just recently, and it's caused explosion of new work, which is really important. But at the same time, the dust is beginning to settle. We recognize, while this represents a whole new class of therapeutics that may not have the toxicities that we associate, the side effects that we associated with cancer therapies in the past, all the nausea and vomiting and the effect on blood counts, on bone marrow depression. But there are new toxicities, previously unseen in some cases, that emerge with these new therapeutics. So they don't come entirely clean, though the spectrum of side effects is in many cases very different than what has been experienced in the past. Hopefully, more manageable.
They also, don't come cheaply. I mean, these biologics are usually hundreds of thousands of dollars per patient per year, which
they certainly can be
over the long haul. May or may not be sustainable for our healthcare system.
Well, in one case, the so-called CAR T therapies, it can be as much as $500,000 to treat a single patient. But this is an extraordinary situation where you're not giving the patient a preformed drug, something that's available for all patients with a specific disease type. You actually have to harvest the lymphocytes from that specific patient, which are then taken to a laboratory somewhere, and where the therapy is developed for that patient alone. So it's a one-off, patient-by-patient. And that's an extraordinary challenge if you think about the scale, the number of cancer patients that need to be treated each year in the United States, if not throughout the world, and having to design and develop a specific therapeutic for that individual patient. It shows how difficult this will be. But the cost associated with that therapy, which is FDA-approved at this present time with more contenders coming, can be hundreds of thousands of
right.
dollars.
I mean, definitely the problem dollars. Is we may be moving into an era when medications are extraordinarily effective and completely unaffordable.
Exactly.
Which is going to be a problem. Let me step back for a minute. So you have been involved on every stage of pharmacology, from a basic researcher to a clinician to an executive, international executive. If you all of a sudden were made commissioner of the FDA, what are some of the steps you would take to help build back trust in the FDA and make it the most effective organization it can be?
Well, two things. I think that the public needs more information, if not actual education, about the process, the uncertainties and certain aspects of it, the difficulty in making decisions, so that there's a sense of realism that this is not a simple machine that you can turn on and get right the first time. There has to be an appreciation of that. There has to be a general buy-in.
Has to be educated. Well, you're really talking about education, aren't you?
Absolutely. So, and at the same time, an understanding that certain safeguards have to be in place to protect patients to the extent that that's possible. It's not completely possible, but to the extent possible. So it's partly the education of the process, public understanding, and an understanding of the need that we can't simply sit back with what we've got. In the case of many diseases, what we have is not satisfactory. And we need to continue to work, make progress, and improve therapeutics for their efficacy as well as their safety. And so that's a challenge that we need to adopt as a society as a whole.
Do you think the FDA itself should be involved with cost effectiveness, or is that something for Congress and the Medicare and other aspects of the government?
I think that it needs to be separated. I think the scientific decisions need to be made cleanly without those considerations. How good is a drug? How effective is it? How safe is it? Those are the judgments have to be, not its relative worth, you know, compared to things on the market. Obviously, in terms of efficacy, that's an important decision. You know, is it as good or better than something that exists? Because that's what we're all looking for. In terms of the financial aspects, most other countries have separated that so that when you get an approval of a drug, you get a technical approval based on safety and efficacy. And then there is a financial approval where you have socialized systems where the government is the principal purchaser of the drug. They enter into a set of negotiations with the drug sponsor to determine what the cost will be to that system.
How has that worked overseas? I mean, England, I assume, is one such place. How do you see that working?
It's been...
Has it diminished the process of the new drug research, or is it?
There has been some checkered history, particularly in the UK. They have a separate body called NICE, National Institute for Clinical Excellence. And this is an external group that reviews the drugs that have achieved technical approval. It makes a decision as to whether or not that agent will be listed on the national formulary, because the drugs are largely being distributed by the National Health Service. So decisions are reached as to whether or not the national system will accept the drug and adopt it. And that's where pricing considerations come very much to the fore. And there have been instances where drugs that we viewed as, in the United States, as being really important breakthroughs, I mean revolutionary in terms of their efficacy relative to what we had, that were initially rejected by the UK and not adopted for years. One instance, a glaring example was in the treatment of a form of leukemia, chronic myelogenous leukemia, and we've labored for decades with old drugs and not all that satisfactorily. And then a new drug came along that was...
We're going to run out of time, and I will tell the listeners we're going to have a show on lymphoma and leukemia, and I know where Dr. Shine's headed with this, and he's right. It was a miraculous medication which has saved a lot of people's lives and given them extra.
And not initially adapted in the
right.
UK.
Well, there are going to be a lot of political decisions and discussion ahead, but you have advanced the field in so many ways, and you've helped educate us here in Vermont about this process. We didn't get a chance to talk about one of your other hats you wear, which is in space research. You've been very involved with the NASA program and the space station. We're going to have you back on a third time at some point. So thank you, Dr. Philip Shine. And thank you all for listening. Please join us next week. We're going to be talking about autism spectrum disorders. Until then, please be kind to yourselves. Be kind to others.